Good morning. My name is Zbigniew Niziębenski, and I'm the president of the Polish-China Business Council. So we live in extremely complicated times. We are observing an accumulation of unprecedented potential health, social, economic, and geopolitical risk. China plays a pivotal role in these processes. For these reasons, it's worth reaching out for comments and advice to outstanding people who not only understand China and the processes that follow, but also people who have a real impact on these processes. One such person is Mr. Jörg Wuttke, president of the European Union Chamber of Commerce in China. It is worth underlining that Jörg has been living in China for about 30 years. Hence, he has an excellent perspective on assessing certain processes in the long term. The European Union in China has more than 1,700 members among 7 chapters operating in 9 cities in China. Jörg is in Beijing now. Good morning, Jörg, or rather good afternoon.
Yes, good morning to you.
I'm very pleased to welcome you and thank you for accepting our invitation. I would like also to remind that Jörg, 3 years ago, participated as a speaker at one of the events organized by Polish Chamber of Commerce. With me in Warsaw is Professor Marcin Jakobi, head of the Department of Asian Studies at SWPS University in Warsaw. SWPS University is a partner of today's event. Good morning, Mr. Professor.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Very glad to be here.
Mr. Professor and me will conduct today's conversation. So maybe let's start with the COVID-19 pandemic. This is the hottest topic right now. We have recently seen a sharp increase of new cases worldwide. We are also observing the increase in Poland. The scale of new cases in the United States, Brazil, and India is terrifying. Now the situation in China seems to be under control. Before we go to the economic issues, please tell us, Jörg, what life in China looks like from a strict perspective. What are the restrictions at the moment? How do the Chinese behave? Do the people keep the epidemic in mind?
Well, thank you for the opportunity, and I wish everyone to stay safe and well. In China, it started, as you know, in Wuhan. We had patient zero, and we had the obvious problems in the beginning in the first 3 weeks. Where the government was pretty much living in denial in the run-up of Chinese New Year. I think nobody wanted to disrupt it and didn't realize the magnitude and the seriousness of the problem. And then lockdown, and then the party rolled out an amazing lockdown protocol. And I would say within a very short term period of time, given that we talk about 1.4 billion people here, they got it under control. Like in my city that I live in, we have 20 million inhabitants, and I guess it's not more than 1,000 people and so forth. And frankly, I trust the statistics because otherwise you would hear rumors and you don't hear that really well. The government was really sloppy in the beginning, but they can count on an incredibly resilient and disciplined people that actually stick to masks, stay at home, and don't do what primarily my own country, Germany, is can be seen, even anti-corona demonstrations. I mean, how stupid can that be?
So especially in a way, now.
I can't relate to this, frankly. And there's this stupid discussion about authoritarian system democracies. Do authoritarian systems work better? It's not proven. Authoritarian problems were obvious in democracies in small countries, particularly Finland and and Portugal showed that these countries coped very well. And then, of course, you have America, which and the UK, which is just hopeless, it seems. No, we came out of it in the beginning, of course, knocked down. Transportation was difficult. We had a supply shock. Productions was mostly hurt. I'm running by on the side as my daytime job, a German chemical company. And we kept producing, but of course, our customers were mostly off. That changed in April when the lockdown was stopped, and we actually went into overdrive. So we have this incredible situation, particularly for European chemicals as well as for car industry, that in May, we were already back on track for the budget. And now most of us are 10-15% above sales last year. So in the manufacturing, you can see that China has a comeback DNA. In the service sector, of course, it was totally different. Knockdown, unemployment. We talk about 100 million people that lost their job in end of February, March. Now, of course, the majority of them is back. It's about, I guess, 60-70 million have found a job again. But many lost their jobs and have to look for other kinds of employment. And you have to keep in mind that in China, only 50% of the people covered by statistics, let alone by insurances. So there is a real shock among the people. And that shows in retail data and in consumer story. You have possibly seen in the newspaper, China in the second quarter was growing 3.2. That was world record globally. But be aware of GDP data. If you dig a hole and you fill it up again, you get GDP twice. So China is producing tremendously well and exports tremendous amounts, meaning the export data was just stunning because the world is in lockdown in many areas and China fills this gap. But what we really need is not China sort of blessing our diverse markets with products. They have to consume, and that's where the problem starts. So we go a little bit from a supply shock to a sort of light demand shock, and that remains to be seen if China manages to convince its population everything is done, you can spend again. We find trust in the market. We are not there yet.
Now you told us that second quarter was pretty good for Chinese economy, yes, that the growth beat forecast and rebounded. So thanks to that, some experts expect positive growth for the whole year of this year. Although some, like Kevin Root, predicts it could be rather 0% as a result of the trade tensions and plunging global economy. And I can add no one factor, another factor, there is a severe floods on this south of the country. So do you think, Jörg, will China be a main engine in the recovery of the global economy this year once again? Yes or no?
I don't think so. Their comeback story, this GDP data for the end of the year, I'm sure is going to be positive. And I don't joke about the government always making up figures. I think it's a genuine possibility of 2% growth year on year, which is quite amazing given the first quarter was a disaster. Second quarter was not bad, and basically we get going. Now, really, will China be the engine of the global economy? That's when the Chinese consumer comes in. It's one thing to produce and send out in the hope the American or European or Polish consumer picks it up. It's something else. Is all of a sudden the Chinese consumer feels good about it and asks for European products, and that remains to be seen. So in a way, I think that it is not happening fast. We come out with a paper from the European Chamber on September 10th, it's our position paper, where actually we try to benchmark the economic development of China over the last 30 years and the prognosis for the next 30 years. Of course, China is the growth story in itself. 30% of global growth in the next 10 years will be China, as much as all the OECD countries together. I mean, chemicals, 60% of global growth chemicals will be here. So long term, I can assure you, no problem. Short term, frankly, I'm very insecure.
The coronavirus pandemic underlines the importance of China's global supply chains, not only as an assembler, but also as a producer of intermediate goods. So it's not wonder China is responsible for 28% of global output. Many countries, especially in Asia, but also in Europe and in the United States, rely on Chinese goods. On this basis, a great discussion began on the restructuring of supply chains, the shift from a global approach towards building regional production hubs in different continents. I wonder, do you think this process will be important in the future and this process will be accelerated, or will these trends fade out, fade away with the end of the pandemic? If so, which sectors of the economy may be affected in the most? And who can benefit most from these processes? Maybe CE regions, maybe Europe. What do you think about it?
Well, if you look at to the service sector, the area most hit by the COVID pandemic, tourism, international travel, you know, you have all kinds of engagement there, retail, you have hospitality and so forth. That, I guess, will remain challenged globally. You know, the Chinese consumer is by far the most happy spending tourist you can imagine. Per year, I guess, round about $300 billion is spent by Chinese tourists. I think we will not see this for quite a while. So all these cities that were sort of building up the facilities for Chinese possibly will be for 1 or 2 years. Challenge, but possibly let's see if how secure everything is. Vaccine, it comes back again. But there's a real interruption within China, by the way. Hotels, particularly in the south, are 90% occupancy. I was shuttling around China last week, the flights were full. So, again, they're an amazing comeback story. When it comes to production, that's a very, very complicated question. Because COVID is the one problem, the U.S.-China trade war is the other problem, where we can see that already now we have this trade impact from tariffs, and now the U.S. Goes into full swing on the technology side, and the financial area, if they use the dollar as a weapon, remains to be seen. And that, of course, will have an impact on supply chains. Now, coming back to COVID, I always get asked, will you diversify? Will you move out of China? First of all, that was a question in February because China had a problem. The world was fine. Now China's okay. The world has a problem. So do I move back again to China? It's not that easy. And it is something where also you have to consider in a global recession, companies struggling with costs, the last thing you do is to build a new plant. You rather shut down plants. We ask our members 10 years ago and then annually, are you considering moving out of China for nationalism, for cost structure, and so forth? And in 2010, 20% said, yes, we're considering it. We asked them again in March, April, and the answer was 10%. So half of the members consider moving out of China in comparison to 10 years ago. That is a clear commitment to the growth story in China. That actually, as I said before, the growth, 30% of global growth is just so staggering. Frankly, the country is also so backward, part of the study in the position paper on September 10th, that diversification away from China virtually is a pipe dream. You cannot really move away from a cluster for electronics in Guangdong, because if you move, for example, to the Philippines, you have one copper supplier. In Dongguan, the hotspot of all these electronics, you have, I don't know, 10, 12 copper producers within 100 kilometers. You have convenience, you have competition. In the Philippines, you're at the mercy of one supplier. How good is this? So in a way, I think this diversification story is not happening, with a notable exception, unless governments want it to happen. And I talk about healthcare equipment as well as pharmaceuticals, where the world has realized that 40% of all medical base load pharmaceuticals come from China. And hence, do you want penicillin in Europe, yes or no? And recently, the last penicillin producer in Austria or in Europe wanted to move to China, all places. And the Austrian government basically subsidized that company to stay. So Europe still has penicillin. So yes, there will be some areas of strategic importance. There will be industrial policy coming up to ensure this. But really, the vast majority will not only stay here, but grow here.
Mm-hmm. So the same, quite the same data we can show in the survey made by American AmCham, yes, and from the watchdogs, Japanese watchdogs, yes, the whole companies want to stay and produce in China because the internal domestic market is so high that it's really profitable to stay in China. So some months ago, you mentioned that you hope that as in 1978 and 1992, Chinese leader will use the current collapse to carry out radical structural reforms. You added in comment that for the European economy, equality between state-owned and private equity companies, including foreign companies, is the most important things. Charlotte Rose, when presenting the vice president of European Chamber, when presenting in the last business confidence survey, also noted that this topic is extremely difficult for the Chinese leadership to tackle, especially now that the economic crisis caused by coronavirus had led to heavy reliance on the COEs in China. What could you add to that? Yeah, this is still a big problem, yes? The quality.
Well, I mean, the big picture is those that can play here, including my own company, we are doing quite well because we have technologies which China needs. We have products that China doesn't produce. And anywhere where China feels like it wants you to help China on the technology, you're always most welcome. You just have to check a couple of years later if you're still alive or China has taken your technology and has improved it. So those like Volkswagen and my own company is in good shape. Of course, that means that a lot of companies that actually want to engage with China on the manufacturing side are either not able to do this for two reasons. One, there's a negative list. And the second reason is that they feel the security, the information and the technology is not secure. And so we have this position paper, 430 pages coming out in September. For the audience, all the papers I talk about, you can go to the europeanchamber.com.cn and download it from publications free of charge. You can see not only China, but also 7 chapters, 9 cities. So lots of stuff in case you really want to study Chinese economy. Again, on the 10th, I can promise you it's going to be 400 pages plus and 800 case studies. We are still lamenting about state-owned enterprises. The president recently has said that SOEs are so important to him. So I guess that, you know, for the next years, I will still talk about SOEs. There is no level playing field between us and the SOEs. There is no level playing field between the state-owned enterprise and the Chinese private enterprises. So it's not just that we are the only victims. Actually, we are small pie victims. The Chinese private enterprises really are struggling big time. So in a way, the inequality is still there. But again, the cake is huge. Even if the cake is growing slowly, you still can have your chunk out of this. The service sector is very complicated because China blocks a lot of stuff. Lawyers and art and old age and so forth is still very much handicapped. And then, of course, you want to have an export of European agricultural products. After all, Europe is the biggest exporter in agricultures, and there the sanitation barriers, the Great Wall of China, is formidable, and you know, particular Eastern European and South European companies, countries that want to sell their excellent products run into the wall. That's really disappointing because China has promised to knock that down. I mean, one of these schemes is 17+1, but we are still waiting for miracles.
But crises such as the current one are not only huge challenge, but also emerging opportunities for companies. Do you see promising areas in China for Polish and European enterprises?
Yeah, I mean, we are trying to outline not only the challenges, of course, also the opportunities. Again, in the forthcoming paper, we show that China has a great growth potential, which you want to be part of. We have three scenarios on, you know, if China reforms, does not reform, or sort of muddles through. But in all of these three scenarios, it's clear that the fastest growing market is going to be here. Just as comparison, China's GDP per capita is 25% of the average American and about 15-16% of the average German. Then, of course, you have Shanghai and Beijing. As if you have seen there, I mean, this is stunning. But still, 50% of GDP per capita in those cities. And then you go to the west of China, and there's just a cool 400, 500 million people living. It's 4-5% of American GDP. So this country actually looks powerful, big and rich. But the good news for business is it's actually quite poor and has a great long ranks to grow. Will they screw up on the way to develop this potential? Yes, it is possible. China is under huge pressure from the United States. I sense great nationalism, and I sense this kind of decoupling that's going to happen. We are very worried about this. Decoupling with the U.S. always puts pressure on European companies. We have seen no benefits so far. The U.S. is withdrawing. We can take part of that business. Not really. So we are doing a decoupling study. We started actually on last Monday, and I'm going to launch it in January as a wake-up call to the European business community in Europe as well as here of how to anticipate this, what to do about it, and recommendations to the Chinese and European officials not to go down the road that West China is going on. But again, in China, clearly Xi Jinping talks about the domestic cycle growing strongly domestically, not so much dependent on export. This sounds very good for us. At the same time, it has a taste of Mao Zedong with self-sufficiency.
All right, thank you very much. Now I would like to maybe go to the topic of politics and economy. You already mentioned a very difficult and tense situation between the US and China. We've seen in recent months, I think, unprecedented moves by the US, very unfriendly towards China in different fields. You mentioned economy, you mentioned technology, but we have to remember about diplomacy, science, education, and of course, health connected with the virus. I remember you said in one of the interviews that the US-China technological war is a bigger risk than the coronavirus. And you added, quote, "When two elephants dance, it's hard to stand aside and not be impacted." Now, my question to you would be, how do you think will American economic pressure on China affect Europe?
I'm glad at least someone reads my interview, so that's highly appreciated. it is something where, you know, China, in a way, decoupled from the world and slowly engaged with the world, with WTO, but they were also the ones that drove away Google, Yahoo, eBay, Amazon, and so on and so on, and developed their own local champions. And of course, now they are extremely successful and technology-wise, very advanced. So in a way, it feels now, in particular in the ICT area, where they go after TikTok and WeChat and Tencent, like payback time. You know, you blocked us, and now it's your turn. Which is greatly unfortunate because the products coming out of China, is particularly WeChat, is incredibly valuable and has long-term implications, because if WeChat is down in the US, Chinese tourists normally pay with a mobile phone. They cannot go shopping anymore. So, and there's always this looming danger that Europe goes down the road of the US and looks at TikTok and Tencent, and all of a sudden Chinese tourists are stranded there as well. Chinese don't have cash anymore. Possibly I'm the last person in the whole of People's Republic who's paying in cash. It's very inconvenient for the shops. So in a way, it is something where we are, as you rightfully put it, we are crossing red line after red line, which was unthinkable a year ago or half a year ago. It really goes in rapid order. Just recently, the closure of a consulate. Now an American secretary is in Taiwan, it's just like, what's next? It has an impact. It has an impact because it is not coming out of the White House. It is bipartisan. It is 66% of the United States population believes that China is a threat. So even if Biden is in office, this is not going to go away. And of course, when two giants quarrel, it's gonna cause a distrust. It causes disruption on R&D. It causes additional cost and complexity. Now, where's Europe in all of this? I always get the question, what do you choose? And my answer is always is we choose Europe. We don't want to sort of be aligned with the US and go down this road of confrontation. But at the same time, we don't want to be an annex to the People's Republic, because their totalitarian system is very different from our democratic system. So in a way, where's Europe in there? We are impacted. If two of our customer base is challenged, then our sales goes down, our cost goes up. At the same time, technology is a real threat. You know, if you are looking into high-tech equipment that you buy in the European Union and you want to sell into China, you will be very surprised to see there might be a list of technologies coming out of the US that has been built into this equipment, automation and all kinds of stuff, software as well as chips and so forth. Now, if you are on that list with 20% of value, you actually, as European, want to sell to China, you have to go to DC getting the approval. Most people are actually not aware of that. So US wants to decouple China technology-wise, and I'm sure they put pressure on Europeans to follow and not take advantage of this one. And so they will watch us very, very closely. The other one is, of course, the nuclear option that I thought half a year ago, there's no way in hell it's going to happen, the financial situation. Will the US decouple China from the US dollar? And as you know, US dollar is 60% of global trade, the renminbi is 2%. So there's no way that China can sort of fill that situation right away. Now, I believe, maybe I'm naive, but I don't believe that China will, the big five banks will go and be subject kind of decoupling from the US dollar, because they deal with North Korea, Venezuela, Iran, and now the latest, of course, Hong Kong. That is a real challenge. I don't think so, but there are 3,500 Chinese banks that have 50% of the asset base, and I'm sure that US will take out, I don't know, 5 or 10, just to prove the point. So you really want to be sure that you deal with other banks than those. So maybe stick to the big five. The big five are the other 50% of the asset base. Now, will China react? They do. Are they thinking about the renminbi to get a convertible? As a matter of fact, yes, they're thinking about it, which is really difficult because China hates volatility, and the currency in markets will be volatile for sure, but it just shows under what pressure this country is. So will this go away? No. Will China change? I don't know. So far, China has been very reluctant of punishing the US, frankly, because they know the US has a bigger weaponry. If there's a new development, you never know. Now, when you ask me about the change in leadership in the U.S., again, don't forget it's bipartisan. It's recently was a vote in the Senate about China. 99 people voted against China, 99 out of 100. So if Biden comes into office, style will change. He will possibly look into global networks, TPP in Asia. He will reach out to Europe, I guess, I hope. But then the question will be, do we team up with the US as like-minded in order to deal with China? That's going to be the crucial question. So far, China has been lucky that Trump has been antagonizing all his normal allies. And then it really gets interesting because China has been antagonizing most of the OECD countries. The Europeans are still okay. One country in particular has been taken up and bullied, India. If Biden is clever, and I'm sure he is, he might try to get in coalition going of OECD plus, and the plus might stand for India. And then, of course, the whole game looks very different.
All right. Thank you very much. You rightly mentioned that it's not just a question of Donald Trump and his personal opinions about China. It's a whole very big and deep long-term shift. And you mentioned a lot of facts concerning the American-China relations. I would like to go back a little bit to the sort of recommendations for us, for Europeans. You also mentioned that we should maybe try and not think about taking sides, but taking the European side and not play into the American hands and sort of try to do everything that the American administration asks us to do. But I'm sure you're aware that many European governments, and especially Polish government, is very, very strongly pro-American. So my question to you would be, what would you advise, for example, Polish politicians in the long term about taking sides and about their strategy towards China in this long-term perspective of course, also keeping very good relationships with the U.S.?
Well, the view I always had is that Poland was very strong pro-China. I mean, after all, 17 or 16 plus one was generated out of Poland. And of course, that changes in particular as the Americans are very subtle people and remind possibly the Poles that Russia is a neighbor and that they need a big brother to look after them, something the Chinese obviously cannot do. So I understand where the pressure comes from. But at the same time, I guess it's very valuable now to see what kind of options and opportunity derives from this situation. Now, Europe has been discussing reforms forever, and we are damn slow on this one, on the education side, on opening up the domestic market, and so forth and so forth. I know the Polish population has just voted not necessarily in this direction, but I can only say if you have a market of 420 or 440 people, as the Brits left, you really want to make sure that this market functions. And the fact that Corona happened as it happened in Europe and that countries closed the border has something to do with the fact that Europe was not open because health is a nation by nation. And of course, you could see the knee-jerk reaction is like, it's my masks and not your masks. So in many ways, I think that for me at least, the crisis has shown that we rather should also coordinate healthcare in order to help ourselves. It doesn't matter, you know, if a house is on fire and the living room is still doing fine, to point out, you know, close the door and leave everyone in misery. So we have to get better. We have to possibly come up with industrial policies. We have to make sure that our education system is up to speed. We have to look into the bandwidth of our internet. We have to possibly sponsor schools better. In Germany, 1% of all the schools give the iPad or something like that to their pupils. In most countries, Korea, for example, it's nearly 100%. So we should learn from Korea. We should learn from other countries. And this kind of massive stimulus that was approved recently by the European Union is a great mechanism in order not to waste it on cows and potatoes, but actually use it for high tech in order that our people get connected and have better chances for higher skilled jobs, because the lower skilled jobs the Chinese have been grabbing, and don't forget India's around the corner. So in a way, it is Europe really has to take this as an opportunity in order to make more unity and less frictions and basically go into high tech. That really, I think the bottom line to me is always the education system. And if you just look, for example, where we start, my company has developed a toolkit for the kindergarten and the primary school to get people excited about chemistry, you know, because kids really don't go into this kind of science anymore. But this is where China and India are brilliant, and this is what we rely on. You know, if we don't watch out, we become a boutique in Europe, looking cool, right, having travelers coming and sort of have the occasional wonderful Thai and champagne. But the fact is that 50% of all the science and technology PhD so far in the US in Ivy League universities were mainland Chinese. So, I mean, we cannot sit on our laurels and believe that, you know, we are just wonderful, democratic, and this will be good enough. We really have to reform. So if we, with the recommendations I gave, is really strengthen also the export ability of our companies and make the market a little bit less bureaucratic, take government out of certain areas so that actually we can generate more business. After all, jobs don't come necessarily from government, but from employment comes from jobs.
All right, thank you very much. One last question from me. The one topic we didn't touch upon is the Belt and Road Initiative. And I would like to go back to the opportunity sort of slogan for Poland mostly, because we have been, I think, quite confident about our geographical advantage in Poland being as some sort of a gateway, mostly in railway logistics between China and Western Europe. Now, do you see that this is an argument at all, and this is the way Poland should take the initiative in building ties with China? Do you think it's a true asset in our hands, or and how do you think we can use it in our contacts with China?
Well, Marcina, I don't want to depress you, but we have a study out since January that you also can download. We ask our members, do you gain out of this? And we have 1,700 members, 140 only replied. That in itself already is interesting. And from these 140 companies, believe it or not, it's 7 or 9 companies had benefit out of Belt and Road. I mean, that's pretty much nothing. And I tell you what happened is the Chinese go global and they do a lot of infrastructure projects that actually might benefit the local economy a lot. Better power, better water treatment, and so forth. But 90% of the added value of these projects stay in China. So China's exporting its procurement model, and basically the money comes from China, but the money goes back to China. And you have maybe as a local economy 4%, and as a multinational or third country, I think it's around about 5 or 6%. It is neglectable. And so you have to be very much aware that actually, if you think that Belt and Road is cool, think about it. If you are competing against Chinese company in Egypt or somewhere else in Africa, you actually can compete. Rest assured, you will not win. So it is really something that people have to wake up to, that it is not World Bank and it's not Asian Developing Bank criteria or European Union criteria. And frankly, also Asian Investment Bank criteria out of Beijing, they're totally level playing and formidable in their performance. So it really is a distorted procurement. You cannot enter the Chinese soft loans. You cannot compete against the kind of China Developing Bank steroids. Now, as you mentioned, transportation, that actually is a real benefit for us because, you know, my own company, we can send stuff from Chongqing to Poland or to Germany. It's 12 days instead of 24, 28 days on the ship. Now, why is that so? Well, first of all, every container out of China is sponsored by 50%, meaning the local government pays $2,500 to $5,000, depending on location and what it is, cooling or not cooling, to the company. So they do this not because you have blue eyes, but the fact is that you compete against China. They want this Belt and Road transportation to be successful. 7,000 trains are going every year, at least last year, to Europe. So companies shipping stuff to Europe are very happy. Unfortunately, most of these trains come back more or less empty. That just shows that actually the openness of the market here would be great if they lay back, they could load up the German beer or maybe some fruits and vegetables from Eastern Europe and so forth. Now, and you also have to look into scale. So 7,000 trains, every train has about 42 containers. So that just gives you a taste of how big that is. Now, if you look at the Maersk or Costco container ships leaving Shanghai, one of them can take 20,000 containers, 20,000 containers. So in a way, yes, there are more trains. And yes, it's an alternative as long as it's subsidized. but don't believe that this is your salvation.
All right. Thank you very much. That's very insightful, I think, especially for the Polish government.
Thank you very much. So I want to return to coronavirus. Yes. So many countries around the world have approved and launched very generous emergency measures. I want to ask you about the scale and, in your opinion, the effectiveness of the Chinese government's rescue package.
Well, they actually are, and that has to do with the vice premier, who is a very smart and extremely cautious character. The rescue package has been actually quite small. You know, if you remember 2008, 2009, I think there was a cool 4 trillion renminbi that was thrown at the economy. Now it has been very pointed, very targeted. So in the old days, if you can compare it, it was sort of take a big bottle of steroids and, you know, gulp it. Today, the vice premier has been handing over small portions in order to stimulate whatever he felt like has to be stimulated. This is really important because whatever you stimulate now, you have to pay back later. And the debt burden in China is 300% nearly of GDP. So there's not much room in order to throw away money. Also, something you have to keep in mind, does China now show the willingness to keep throwing money at the world, be it Venezuela, be it Pakistan, be it Iran, and be it Belt and Road? Think again. So the money is needed in China. So what they're doing is they go back to square one infrastructure, of course. They're building again. They use it smartly in many ways. 5G is the topic. So it's not just the additional theater or a sports stadium that nobody needs. So they are actually quite moderate in stimulating this, nowhere close to what the US or Europe have done. And I guess the latest figures have shown that actually the economy from the production side is coming back faster than we thought. So for me, it would be far more important that the Chinese government is not throwing money at cities, but is actually considering to build up a healthcare system that people can afford and unemployment schemes that people feel safe. Again, I come back to the beginning of my explanations that China's consumer is very important. If the Chinese consumer doesn't buy and China only produces, it's not the motor of the world, it is the factory of the world.
Okay, thank you very much. So for the people who are doing business in China, very significant problem is ability to travel to China without quarantine. Yes. What are the regulations in China in this regard?
Oh, it's a nightmare. See, I mean, I would love to be in Europe now. And if I would be in Heidelberg, you invite me, I would be on the next flight to Poland, believe me. It is
very... We invite you.
Oh, thank you. Don't forget this. But I might not be there for the next 6 to 12 months, I'm afraid. Now, what happened is that China on 23rd of March closed the borders to foreigners. And that means every foreigner. So when Europe closed its borders, Chinese residents with a visa from Germany or Poland could return to their job or to their hometown in Europe. Whereas our people that have a resident visa paying taxes here are stuck in Europe. We have at this stage, I think, 125,000 foreigners stuck outside, and hence we don't know when they come back. Now, China has been implementing a very rigid system with quarantine, and that is the real bottleneck. 14 days, you have to do a quarantine in the city you arrive, and very often, like our general manager, who just came in from Hong Kong to Shanghai, he's coming today to Beijing. He has to do another 7 days, can you believe it, in Beijing. I mean, it's madness, frankly. So you have 2 weeks quarantine. Now, there's a flight coming in, on average 200 people, because only a quarter, three quarters of the flight can be occupied, social distance. That means one flight, one hotel, down for 2 weeks. And the hotel has, of course, the reputation of being a COVID hotel. How many hotels does China contribute in order to do this? Not many anymore. So in a way, we have a situation where the bottleneck is the quarantine facilities. Unless China changes this to 7 days or to 2 days and then home quarantine, which is hard to supervise, then I'm afraid these foreigners will stay out of the country at least until Christmas or March. And it really bites because we need 1,908 teachers in Beijing again to start our school year. And they all, of course, have dependents. We count all together for Beijing 4,000 people. That's cool, 20 plane. And you need a visa. And you need an invitation letter from the local government. I wrote to Foreign Minister Wang Yi, and I've lobbied strongly with the local governments over the last 4 weeks. And actually, this week was a real breakthrough. On Wednesday, Tuesday, China got rid of this, so we think, of this PU letter, it's called, meaning you need a local invitation from your community in order to get to the embassy and get a new visa. This apparently was taken away. And I say apparently because it was posted on two Chinese embassies in Denmark and in Germany and was taken down again. So, and hey, I hope this is the case. So check out on the Chinese embassy in Warsaw. So with that, you get a new visa. And again, we don't know if everyone gets a visa or only these chief representatives or the R&D heads and so forth. And again, the SMEs, you know, do they have the magnitude to be important to China? And the majority of our companies here, as well as the Polish companies, is SMEs. And if the guy hasn't been here for 6 to 8 months, his company goes belly up. We had many cases where Europeans basically says, I will not come back to China because my company is anyhow bankrupt by now. So MNCs like my own easily can survive. We close ranks, we do better. But it's a nightmare when you look at SMEs, and particularly on the teacher side. And we need teachers in order to actually have the ability to recruit the best people, mostly with families, to come to China. So this is when Ursula von der Leyen was calling me up for the summit before, what is the biggest problem you have? I said, teachers and SME heads, boil it down. It's not market access. We are really in a crisis over here. So let's see if China reacts on this one. And that also, of course, depends on the European countries. Are they safe or are they not safe? You know, and it looked like everyone is moving in the right direction. And now basically we have bad news left and right. So it also depends on you guys if China opens up.
So you mentioned the Polish SMEs. So I have the question connected with this. How could the EU Chamber of Commerce in China support Polish business in China?
Well, first of all, we have great events, and given the crisis, everything is pretty much online. So if you go into our website on events, you can actually then see where you can participate. If you want to get smart about what the issues are, again, you don't have to read 400 pages about problems in China. You go to biotechnology, you go to chemistry, you go to car parts, wine and spirits, boiler. I mean, God knows we have 33 working groups. So there are the assessment on the market. There's an assessment on the challenges. And of course, we end up with recommendations. And then to add your information also, of course, is the local position papers, because China's a continent. And you want to know what's different between Guangdong in the south and Shenyang in the north. What is the local business, European business community telling us on taxation, on kind of electricity, schooling, hospitals, government access, licenses, blah, 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 blah. Because it's really different. I mean, China has 33 member states called provinces. Europe only has 27 by now. And you also have to keep in mind that this really is not a country. This is a continent. And Guangdong, for example, Guangdong has 100 million people. That's two times Poland, I can imagine. And so you have 100 million people with the GDP of Russia. Russia is, as an economic power, one province in China. And then if you look at the city of Shenzhen, which is sort of the high-tech powerhouse of China, Shenzhen has the GDP of South Africa.
It's impressive.
Yeah, people have no idea. People can't relate. The magnitude of demand story. So, yeah, stuff like this you can learn from the chamber about Belt and Road, but it's very sobering, maybe in the evening with two whiskeys or two vodkas. And then, of course, the events that we do. But if you want to really have entry points where you want to go into Shanghai or Beijing, the best I can recommend are the German centers. They're open for Europeans, definitely, because there you sit among, in Shanghai, 500 German or international SMEs. You get a desk, you get a room, and you have all the access to information there. And it's really important. It's like an incubation center because you want to go to your colleagues and say, you know, where do I get best people? What does an employment contract look like? How do I pay taxes? European Chamber cannot do this, and we don't want to do this. This is subject to the bilateral chambers, and the Germans have the biggest system here by far, and they do it in English, and they do it for everyone from Europe. So you can go there for the practical questions. We are there for the broad information, and we have chambers in 9 cities, as you said, so you can always network there.
I hope that Polish entrepreneurs use it. These possibilities. So I would like to thank you, Jörg, for your extremely valuable insights and comments. I hope they will be useful for Polish businesses. I hope that in some time we will be able to meet again and discuss about really important world matters and for us citizens directly. I would like also to thank Professor Marcin Jacobi for the joint interview at SWPS University for supporting this event. We invite you to the next events organized by Polish China Business Council and encourage everyone to visit our website pchrb.pl. Thank you very much for the meeting. Marcin Jacobi and Zbigniew Niesiebenski, we hope you will join us for the next interview. Thank you very much.